Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two of our 2018 Ig Nobel Prize recipients episode. I was going to say, if you haven't heard part one, you need to go back and listen to that first, but you don't really. I mean,
no,
you should go back and listen to it, but you can understand this episode without hearing that one.
That's right. We're just covering all the winners across two episodes. Ultimately, it doesn't matter which order you take them in, though the top of the first episode has just a brief section where we talk about what the Ig Nobel Prizes are. So if you're not sure on that, I would recommend checking that little bit out. But if you've been listening to the show for years, you know that we continually do this. We do this pretty much every November, sometimes in October, but generally it's a November situation where we catch back up, see what the previous months or technically September's honorees were for the Ig Nobel Prizes, and we just talk about them a little bit. Sometime in the past, we've done two hosts talking about it. We've done three hosts talking about it. We've tried to cover them all in a single episode. We've covered them across three episodes. This week, it's just Joe and I, and we are doing it in two episodes. So some of these descriptions are shorter than others. It kind of depends on what kind of meat is on the bone.
Speaking of, if you haven't listened to our last episode, it had some good stuff about cannibalism. So you might want to check that out.
All right. Well, speaking of meat, though, let's go ahead and jump into biology.
Okay, the biology prize for 2018. I got to start with a question. Robert, you know, some people are these, what would you call it, the unbothered eaters, the cool hand Lukes of eating stuff. If your everything bagel falls on the floor, you just pick it up and eat it. Oh. It's just a little more of everything, right? Robert, are you like that, or are you somebody who can't tolerate getting a few hairs off the floor on your food?
I'm not going to pick a hair off of it, but if I drop something and it's just there for a second and the floor looks relatively clean, mm-hmm. especially if it's in my own house, then yes, I'll probably eat it. I do have limits, though. I mean, there have been times, especially when I've been places with my son, who especially when he was a little younger, there was a higher probability that what he was trying to eat might fall onto the ground. I particularly remember eating these delicious fish sandwiches in Barbados at this place called Cuz's Cutters, Cutter being the the Bajan, I believe, slang for a sandwich. Uh-huh. But it was just like a delicious fish and cheese sandwich with some Bajan hot sauce. Absolutely delightful. And we were just eating it over just this, like it was just, you know, like gravel and some bottle caps. And uh-huh. and it was just on the brink of falling apart in my son's hands. And I just saw it in my mind, like that fish is going to hit the ground. The fish patty's going to jump out of the sandwich.
Uh-huh.
And there's just going to be no reclaiming it. Luckily, it didn't happen.
Oh, thank the gods for that. That's a deliverance.
Right. But if I were in my own house and that were to happen, I would say, no, we're not throwing that fish patty out. We're going to pick that up. We're going to brush it off and you can finish it.
Okay, parts two and three coming. Part two, you're at a restaurant. You find a hair in your soup. Do you just pick it out and keep eating the soup, or do you eat the hair, or do you abandon the bowl completely?
I think I have a pretty good ability to quickly remove a hair and almost kind of delete the memory of it occurring and keep going, especially as long as it's, you know, relatively good. If the food was already offending me, I don't know, it might be different.
Yeah, you like Men in Black pin yourself.
And yes,
it's just like it's wiped clean.
Yeah, it's like, oh, not seeing it now, didn't see it. You're just going to keep moving.
Okay, here's the last one. What if there's a fly in your glass of wine or your cocktail or whatever? Do you still drink it, or is the glass ruined?
Has the fly simply landed on the glass, or is it floating dead in my drink?
That's a good question. Let's just say it's in the liquid. It's in there.
Well, once it's in the liquid, that is kind of gross. I mean, you can't help, especially if you're drinking something outside, you can't help but have fly or even like a yellow jacket or something sometimes land on your drink, and there's nothing to be done. If a fly is just floating in there, I might have to send it back.
Sometimes those flies can be disease vectors.
Yeah.
You don't know what they were landing on before this. They might have been on sewage. I mean,
I think that's a bridge too far for me, even though it's gross enough if one lands on something you're eating or drinking, but there's something about the fleeting contact. As gross as it is, I can delete the memory and keep moving.
Right.
But if I have to fish a body out of my drink, I don't know.
Well, here's another thing. Have you ever noticed if a fly landed in your drink, if you could smell it?
No, I've never noticed that.
Well, maybe this is something to check out next time, because that's what this year's Biology Prize concerns. So the paper in question here is called The Scent of the Fly by Paul Becher, Sebastian LeBreton, Erica Wallen, Eric Hedenstrom, Philippe Barrero-Echeverri, Marie Bengtson, Volker Jorger, Peter Witzgall. Oh, that's the whole list. That's a lot of names.
Well,
sorry.
Congrats. I would have just et al'd the crap out of that one.
Oh, man. I probably should have, but yeah. Okay. So I've got a new word for you, Robert. Simiochemicals. You heard that one before?
No, it's a new one on me.
Simiochemicals. Okay. It just means chemicals used for communication, like semiotics and signs, study of signs, sending communications. So the authors of this study point out that all living things communicate by way of chemicals. Quote, unlike sounds or sights, semiochemicals interconnect species across kingdoms and enable information exchange between animals, plants, and microorganisms. And I think there's some indication that's true, like that there are chemical signals that allow your body to communicate with your microbiome.
Yeah, all right. Or maybe I'm going out on a limb here, but I mean, it seems like some obvious ones would be the smell of rotting flesh or rotting organic material.
Right.
Kind of sends a signal across a species.
Yes, you're communicating in a way with the bacteria that are consuming that flesh.
Mm. And also, I'd imagine that the smell of something especially sweet, the smell of nectar, et cetera.
Right. You might be communicating with a plant. Yeah, exactly. So a fascinating takeaway from this knowledge is that the same one biocompound may be bioactive for different species in different ways. In other words, one semiochemical communicates something to both you and some other animal, say your dog or an insect, but what it communicates is radically different. And anybody who has a dog, in fact, probably is familiar with this, because something that smells repulsive to you smells delicious to your dog. So one example is, don't you just love the clean, fresh scent of citrus? You know, it's a very calming smell that makes you feel like everything is spick and span.
Yes, unless it's actual spick and span, you know?
Right. Oh, like, I don't know actual spick and span.
Well, at least spick and span is a cleaning product, right? Which
is that the yeah, that's right.
But it does. This touches on one of the key differences for me. If it's legitimate citrus, yes, it's beautiful. I love the smell. But if it's something that is like a fake lemon smell, then there's something unnatural about that.
Well, did you know I actually came across a paper while I was reading about this that found that like the title of it was something like lemon fresh scent causes flies to lay eggs. So lemon fresh scent, it's a chemical cue that says to you, ah, this place is clean and delightful, unless maybe it's the synthetic smelling kind that you don't like. But
so this might be why the fly would be seeking out, say, my tiki drink.
Yeah, it's got a lemon fresh scent. It says to the flies, lay your eggs here. This is a great place. And this is probably because the vinegar fly, Drosophila melanogaster, prefers to deposit its eggs in the peel of citrus fruit as long as yeast is present there. And so this particular study, the Ig Nobel winning study, focuses on a compound called Z4-undecinyl or Z4-11-AL. Undecinyl or undecylaldehyde is an organic compound that can be found in citrus oils. So Z4-11-AL, you can associate it with a kind of citrus peel, clear, oily liquid kind of thing. And it is one of these volatile compounds that plays a role in the life of multiple organisms. In vinegar flies, Z4-11-AL is produced by females, and it seems to play a role in the attraction of male mates. But Z4-11-AL is also bioactive in other organisms. For example, Z4-11-AL is produced in the anal glands of male rabbits, such as the European wild rabbit, and it's got a mini-splendored scientific name, Oryctolagus cuniculus.
Ooh, very nice.
Yeah, that should be a Bond villain name. And so experts believe this volatile compound might play some role in territorial marking, and one reason for thinking that is that like studies have found that when you have other male rabbits smell this compound, their heart rates shoot up. Maybe like, oh, there's another dude around here not having it.
Oh, I got you.
A related similar scent has also been found to emanate from the colonies of a seabird called the crested auklet, which is Aethia cristatella. And this scent has been tracked to two associated aldehydes. It's not exactly the same. It's not Z4-11-AL, but it's the chain-shortened analog Z4-decinyl, Z410AL and Z2-decinyl. And researchers think that these smells function as a parasite repellent and an advertisement of mate quality. Another interesting link, like we've talked about before, between mating advertisements and the avoidance of parasites, right? Sometimes when you're showing off how good of a mate you are, what you want to show is, I got no parasites on me, look and see. Oh, and I also just included an image of what crested auklets look like because they look really funny.
Ooh, yeah, they're beautiful. These are some beautiful birds. And if you want to check out a picture of them, again, the spelling on that auklet is A-U-K-L-E-T.
Yeah, they've got so they've got crests like sort of mohawks going out of, I don't know what you'd call that part of the face, the bridge of the nose over the beak, that like shoot out forward, and then they've got really funny googly eyes.
Yeah, they are like googly eyes, those eyes.
But anyway, so back to the compound we're talking about, Z4-11-AL. But the funny thing this study found is that apparently humans are also highly sensitive to the smell of this particular compound. So it comes out of rabbit anal glands. It comes out of auklets. But humans also find significant the smell of Z4-11-AL, even in tiny quantities. And thus, humans are highly sensitive to the smell of the female fruit flies, or not fruit flies, actually. They're often called fruit flies, but technically they are vinegar flies that produce it. And there was an experiment that proved this. It was a wine tasting.
Ha.
So you got eight members in the study. It was two women and six men who were trained wine assessors, wine experts, you know, those people, the sommelier types, who I think they worked in the wine industry assessing wines in Germany. And each sampled the aroma of multiple randomized glasses across a few tests. So across the different tests, these glasses contained either nothing in the control condition or the scent of a female fly, which produces the compound, the scent of a male fly, which does not produce the compound, various amounts of synthesized, like lab-made Z4-11-AL, tested against a background content of nothing water or white wine. I believe it was a dry Pinot Blanc from 2013. And the results were that tasters could strongly detect the smell of a single female fly or the presence of isolated Z411AL in the glass. It was even perceptible at 1 nanogram. That's 1/1,000,000th of a gram per glass. So even at the smallest concentrations, the compound was described as unpleasant and as an off flavor. At higher concentrations, it was perceived as a loud off flavor. And so the authors write, quote, "This supports the observation that one fly spoils a glass of wine after falling into it, provided it is of the female sex." So it wouldn't just be the conceptual gross out of having a fly fall in your wine. You wouldn't have to think through, oh, this could be a disease vector, or, oh, it's grossing me out for this reason or another. Just if it's a female fly, just the smell of it could be repellent enough that you would detect it and you would find the glass revolting afterwards.
Interesting.
So that's the funny part of the study. Obviously, you got wine tasters like sniffing glasses with flies in them.
Right. And everybody loves I mean, anytime there's a scientific article about wine or wine tasting, people tend to read it, even if it's relatively unamusing. But I actually would love to do another episode in the future just on wine and wine tasting, and not only the biological aspects, but of course the psychological aspects. We have an older episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind that went into it a little bit, but I feel like didn't really give the importance of priming and the psychological weight of wine tasting, you know, your expectations, the story that's told about it, et cetera.
Oh, I'd be more than happy to come back to that. So that's the funny part. The funny part is them sniffing flies. The interesting question, though, is why? Why are humans so sensitive to Z411AL? It's this compound that's very relevant to the lives of these vinegar flies, right? So if you're a Drosophila, this compound is super important to your mating process. But why do humans find it repellent in food consumption contexts? The answer to this question is not currently known. It's not clear that this compound is of any biological significance to humans. So the authors hypothesize, well, let's see, what could be the reasons? Maybe it's reminiscent, they say, of, quote, other food aldehydes. So like our sensitivity to it could be part of a general food hunting olfactory package. But then again, why would it repel us in the context of wine? And we know that sometimes some food smells can be attractive in one context and repellent in another, like certain smells associated with cheese, right?
Right. Yeah. There have been some wonderful studies that have shown that if you smell the same thing, if you're told that it's a shoe, you'll be grossed out. If you're told that it's a cheese, then you'll run grab some crackers.
Delicious. Yeah. And I suspect that same smell, which would seem to be delicious on a cheese, if you smelled it on, like, I don't know, a bunch of strawberries or something, you would probably think something was wrong with them. You'd be grossed out.
Yeah.
But I don't know that. That's just I'm supposing. But then again, they also hypothesize, the authors do, that the human sensitivity could exist in order to, quote, avert ingestion of fruit that is infested with vinegar flies, which, as we were talking about earlier, can, of course, be covered in microbes and can easily be a disease vector. But at this time, we just don't know the answer. We don't know why this smell is so salient to humans. You would think there would need to be a reason for that, but we don't know what it is. Also, the authors note that Z411AL is, of course, found in citrus essential oils. For example, it's part of the smell of clementines, and the authors point out that it could play a double role in signaling, not just as a sign of food, but as a sign of social significance, for example, mate location or territory marking in not just flies but other animals as well. Coming back to this theme that the same compound that's very significant to one animal could be significant but have a totally different meaning to a different animal. And ultimately, the authors propose at the end that they just want more research to provide a deeper understanding sort of the ecology of smells, the way volatile compounds connect different organisms to one another. And they write, quote, "A future challenge is to extend functional, behavioral, ecological, and phylogenetic studies to include vertebrates toward an understanding of the chemical vocabulary that interconnects us with other living things."
Huh. This is a great prize winner for the Ig Nobels, I think,
because I agree.
It touches on two areas. For starters, it has that obvious, funny mental image of someone smelling the wine and saying, "There's a fly in this."
Mm-hmm.
But then it does get into this like the deeper role of these chemical signals and the mystery of exactly why they're setting us off like this.
Mm-hmm.
There's a mystery to it.
Yeah, I liked this one a lot.
All right. On that note, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will look at another 2018 Ig Nobel Prize winner. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
All right, we're back.
All right, so I want to talk about the Reproductive Medicine Prize.
Okay.
So this...
I like how they have a special category for reproductive medicine because you know they've got to get more of this kind of stuff in there. Yeah,
yeah, because there it's going to be a lot of, essentially a lot of penis jokes, I think, are the typical winners. I'm going to have to look back at some past winners to make sure that's the case, but it's certainly the case with this particular winner. The title of the study that is honored is Nocturnal Penile Tumescence Monitoring with Stamps.
Stamps, like postage stamps?
Yes, with postage stamps.
The kind you get at the post office?
Exactly. and this was published in Urology back in 1980 by authors Barry, Blank, and Beaulieu. So for this one, we're going to have to talk a little bit about nocturnal penile tumescence, or NPT, as it's also known. Exactly what is this? This is, of course, morning wood. That's kind of the colloquial term, right? This is the common slang for it. This is often experienced by males, a waking and perhaps unexplained erection.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the interesting thing, of course, is that the stiffening of the member in question is not the work of devilish succubi or experimenting aliens.
I'm sure those have been blamed over the years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that obviously, because think of it. You have, say, particularly if you have a pious individual, someone who is, due to their particular religious thinking, you know, abhor the temptations of the flesh and, you know, are staving off their primal hunger. What does it mean when they're waking up in the night or in the morning with a full erection, like fully physiologically aroused?
And had to be a demon.
Yeah, it must be a demon. And then, of course, in some cases, there has been nocturnal emission. There has been discharge. Mm. So it seems like some sort of act has taken place. Perhaps, too, this is coupled with dreams. So we have all sorts of human complexities that are layered on top of that that can lead to some confusion. But of course, it's none of these things. It's not the work of the devil, et cetera. In fact, you know, a healthy male experiences up to five. I've seen as high as like – I've seen 3 to 6 also as a figure. Mm-hmm. But say 5 or 6 of these a night as part of his regular REM sleep. In fact, NPTs are so normal that doctors test for them when diagnosing erectile dysfunction. Because, you know, think of it. If these erections occur on their own during the night, then the patient's waking problem is likely psychological rather than physiological.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Now, you might be wondering, though, why do they happen at all then?
Good question, yeah.
Well, since they occur during the REM cycle, there's always the potential for sexually charged dream tie-in, but it's not necessary. The main NPT theories actually have nothing to do with dreams at all, rather that the body may be oxygenating the penile tissue as a sort of maintenance procedure. And the stimulant for this is thought to be the release of nitric oxide by nerve fibers in the penis. Oh, and then there's also the full bladder angle as well.
Hmm.
The two often occur together, and scientists have taken note of this as well. So, for instance, a male will wake up in the morning, there is an erection, and at the same time, they perhaps illogically, it seems, need to urinate pretty badly as well.
Mm-hmm.
So some theories view NPT or morning wood as the body's anti-bedwetting, one of the body's anti-bedwetting measures, and perhaps a wake-up call to the sleeper himself.
Hmm.
So this particular study with the stamps, it has to do with NPT's role in figuring out what's going on with erectile dysfunction.
Not with where to mail it.
Right. Yeah, there's no, the postage is not intended for mailing purposes. Again, think about it. Aside from self-reporting, how do you figure out if a patient has experienced an erection during the night?
Oh, yeah.
Because certainly—
well, I mean, I guess you could like have them come into a clinic overnight, right?
Right. Yeah, you could do some sort of observation, but— you know, there are a couple of problems with that. It's costly. You're asking them to sleep somewhere else, or you're thinking about putting somebody in their room to watch them sleep. These are just not good solutions, and you're also disrupting their life. You're sort of disrupting their natural sleep cycles potentially by doing this.
Right.
So there have been a few different methods to figure out what's going on with the penis during sleep. One method that has been employed is Rigiscan. So this is a battery-powered instrument that places one loop around the base of the penis and the other at the tip. And these loops tighten every 15 to 30 seconds. And the recording unit itself that is attached to these two loops, that straps to the waist or to the thigh. So it regularly tests to see how engorged and rigid the member is throughout the night.
Okay. Sounds cumbersome. I don't want to, you know, cast. Maybe that's a very useful device.
Yeah, I looked at a picture of it. I mean, it doesn't look that bad. It doesn't. If it sounds torturous, it does not look torturous. Mm-hmm. The other method is this popular is the penile plethysmograph. This is a pulse volume recorder wired to a penile cuff that measures blood flow.
Uh huh. I know I've heard about things like this being used in studies that are trying to detect physiological signs of sexual arousal.
Right. I believe this one, for instance, comes up in Silence of the Lambs, I believe. It's like something that they would put on someone and show them films of horrible things and see if they're sexually aroused by them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
So these two methods we've discussed are pretty accurate. And are generally considered more accurate, I understand, than the stamps method. But back in 1980, the researchers in question presented the stamp method. Quote, a stamp technique was developed to detect complete nocturnal erections for the evaluation of impotence. The test correctly detected complete nocturnal erections in 22 potent men and absence of complete nocturnal erections in 11 impotent men. This is a simple, useful screening test for organic impotence. So the idea here is fairly simple. You take a ring of postage stamps, so they haven't been separated, and you know they have the perforated edges, you know, so they pop apart easily.
Okay.
So you take this ring of stamps and you affix them around the penis in its non-erect, unengorged state, and then the individual goes to sleep. The subject goes to sleep, and the next morning they check for breakage. if that ring of stamps has broken, and again, it should ideally break easily because of the perforations, this will be a sign that an erection has occurred. And this has some key advantages, right? It's low cost.
Right.
Just the cost of postage, basically.
Unless the cost of postage goes way up.
Right. There's going to be a regional determinant there. Also, yeah, don't buy rare stamps. Just buy buy the forever stamps, I guess.
Somebody doing it with like the thousands of dollars of stamp collector stamps.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, don't use those. But yeah, it's low cost. It also can be self-administered with ease. You don't even necessarily have to have a doctor involved there, right? So that's part of the appeal.
Doesn't sound too dangerous.
No. Yeah, it's going to break apart the stamps. So you don't have to worry about like constriction so much. The only real risk, of course, is accidentally mailing the penis.
Right.
But that's a joke. Now, some studies have backed up the effectiveness of this particular method. 1988 paper titled Nocturnal Penile Tumescence Monitoring with Stamps in Impotent Diabetics found that, quote, the diagnostic value of this method is nearly the same as that of MPT recording with a strain gauge. And that's from Diabetics Research and Clinical Practice. However, The problem with the stamp method is that there's always the chance that shifting around in one's sleep will simply tear the perforated edges, tear the stamps without an erection taking place at all, and that would give you a false positive.
That'd be a type 1 error.
Right. And then the problem there is if you're trying to treat some sort of impotence scenario, then you start treating as if it's psychological when it's really a physiological ailment.
Hmm.
So that's the risk. So why is this important? Well, because erectile dysfunction is a legitimate medical concern. And it's funny because it involves a penis and morning wood. And these are inherently
and
funny
stamps.
Concepts. And stamps, like stamps and penis. It's really – I mean, in retrospect, it's kind of surprising it took the Ig Nobels this long to honor these researchers.
Well, Robert, that one made me laugh and even sort of a little bit made me think. It's good to think about, you know, what are the – maybe not as perfectly effective, but cost-effective, safe things people can do to substitute for expensive medical tests. Obviously, sometimes you're going to value accuracy over, you know, cost-effectiveness and stuff like that. But with some of these things, you know, it seems like it's worth doing a cheap test before you spring for the expensive test.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. I should add that I also saw a criticism of the stamp test being that we're entering an age where people have decreased access to traditional stamps. And so
right.
That could be a potential problem. The doctor says, you need to get some stamps for your penis. And then your response is, what are stamps?
Couldn't the urologist just have medical stamps. Like they could have stamps that you
with
get
no
prescribed.
Postage value at all.
Or I guess it probably be over the counter. Would they need to keep that behind the counter? Yeah.
But then what about the embarrassment when you accidentally try and mail something? You start mailing your Christmas cards and
with
you realize,
your medical stamps.
I use my medical penis stamps.
Do they say penis stamps on them? Like
yes,
that's totally clear.
They say, warning: medical penis stamp. No postage value.
Yeah. Oh, I think we need to go to another one.
Okay, let's move on.
Okay, I want to do one that we can look at pretty quick. Quick question, Robert. Do you read the user manual when you buy a thing and it comes with a manual?
I guess it depends on the thing.
Yeah.
It also depends on how excited about the thing I am versus like how much just pure drudgery is the thing.
Does being excited make you more or less likely to read the manual?
If I'm more excited, then I'll probably be more likely to read the manual because I want to know how it works. It's like it's the thing's functionality is you know, I want to be it to be a part of me. Mm-hmm. Where if it's something like a refrigerator, like I know how a refrigerator works, and I don't want any more details. I just want it to work. That's all I ask.
Do you read the owner's manual when you get a new car, like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Twins?
No, did he do that?
Yeah, he did. No. He's like, there's a scene where they're riding around in a car, and Arnold Schwarzenegger is reading through some book, and Danny DeVito asks him what he's doing, and he's like, "I'm learning to drive." it's been a long time since I've seen that. I might not be remembering correctly, but I think that's pretty dead on. No, a lot of times I don't read the manual either. I especially love it when there are manuals for things like the refrigerator that you just don't need a manual for. It's like if you don't automatically know how to use this thing, you're in trouble.
Right. And I'm not authorized to fix most things. If it is something I can fix, then yes, maybe I'll pop up in the manual if I know where the manual is.
User manuals are sometimes worth looking at just to see if there's any hilarious bad writing or bad translation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that can be fun. I will take one thing back. One item that I did read the entire user manual for was the Instapot.
I've got one of those. That's great. Free plug. They did not pay us for this.
Yeah, I love it. It helps me. We mostly use it as like a rice and bean cooker.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of these devices when we got it. I was like, all right, I have no idea how this works. I need to know how this works. I guess I'm going to read the user manual. And then I was good to go.
I know y'all don't often eat meat at home, but if you're ever making like a you know, tough pork or beef dish or something like that, it's just fantastic.
Like if I have a human heart
that you need to tenderize real good, it's great for that. It's really good for lentil dishes. Mm-hmm. It's the lentils real nice and like they keep their texture and shape, but they get tender. It's great.
Yeah. We've definitely used it on some lentils.
Okay. We're getting distracted just gushing about our pots. The 2018 Literature Prize of the Ig Nobels was given to Thea Blackler, Rafael Gomez, Vesna Popovic, and M. Helen Thompson, quote, for documenting that most people who use complicated products do not read the instruction manual. And this was a paper called Life's Too Short to RTFM. I think that's read the field manual, that not another F modifier. How users relate to documentation and excess features in consumer products. So this study investigated people's relationship with two aspects of consumer products, number of features in an interface and product documentation, the manual. So the authors did two sets of studies to look at the manuals and the excess features in common household products. And they write, quote, the quantitative set was a series of questionnaires administered to 170 people over 7 years. The qualitative set consisted of 2 6-month longitudinal studies based on diaries and interviews with a total of 15 participants. And here's what they found. First of all, most people don't read the manual, and most people do not use all the features on the products they have. Quote, people claim to read the manual and use all of the features of many common domestic and personal products only 25% of the time.
I have to add that clearly one of the reasons that this study was honored is that it does something that the Ig Nobel Prizes frequently like. It points out something that is blatantly obvious and backs it up with scientific rigor.
You know, I actually like studies like that. People react on social media when there's like a study that shows direct evidence of something that should seem obvious, and then people respond like, duh, why'd you have to do a study on that? That's obvious. No, it's – I mean, all the time we have beliefs about things that seem obvious, but they're in fact not true.
Exactly.
Tons of things that you think are obvious are false. And when a study shows you that something you think is obvious is actually backed up by evidence, that's valuable information.
Exactly.
So anyway, rant end on that. But this one might be less less life and death than some of these things that people think are obvious. But I do think it's kind of interesting about our relationship with our products. Okay, so here's another question. Most people don't read the manual and don't use all of the features on complicated products. But who actually does read the manual? Who's more and less likely in terms of like the demographics? Turns out women are less likely than men to read the manual and use all of the features. Young people are less likely than middle-aged and older people to read the manual and use all the features, and more educated people are less likely to read the manual.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know if these groups actually compound on top of each other. I'm not sure whether that's the case, but if they do, you would say statistically the person most likely to read the manual is like a lower education, older male, and statistically the person least likely to read the manual is a higher education, younger woman.
Okay.
Also, people do not like excess features on a product interface. So excess features, they say, quote, are associated with negative affect, whereas core features are associated with positive affect. Again, this might be kind of obvious, but people don't really like all the bells and whistles. They like a product to be good at the main thing it's supposed to do.
So I wonder how most people feel about those food-specific buttons on microwaves, like popcorn.
I hate those things.
Well, whatever the other. The popcorn's the only one I've ever attempted to use, and I've only used it like once, and I burned popcorn.
Oh, really?
And, yeah. So I just do my own thing.
I could not tell you what those buttons on my microwave say. Like there could be one that says human flesh, and there could be another one that says like, I don't know, a bucket full of lollipops, and I wouldn't know. I've not looked at them.
I didn't figure out how the power percentage on my microwave worked until like the last year or two.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then I started noticing, oh, wait, this particular microwave dish requires that I use 50% power. How do I do that? And then I have to figure it out. But I never looked at the manual. I stuck to my guns on that one.
So you actually follow instructions on microwavable meals. You don't just press 666 like a lot of people do.
I didn't know people did that. No.
Sometimes people do that.
I mean, that's a solid choice. Good
that's
number.
That's a steady tradition in my family. No, I think it usually comes out better if you follow the instructions. That's kind of like reading the manual. Also, people hate having to consult the manual to figure out how to use something. Quote, reading of manuals appears to cause annoyance and negative emotional experiences, unquote. On average, people just want their products to be self-explanatory. They do not want to have to read all that stuff and deal with a bunch of extra features and settings. They want stuff to be easy and intuitive, and they don't want to read manuals.
So I wonder what companies should learn from this. Like, is there a lesson here for the creation of manuals or the creation of alternative materials regarding the use of their products?
That's a good question. I mean, generally, I think it should be the case that if it's possible for you to make an interface, a product interface, self-evident, like it should just be obvious how the product works and how you're supposed to use it, you should do that. Now, obviously, you can't always do that. There are going to be lots of kinds of features of products that are more complicated. They can't just be totally obvious on the interface. So in that case, I don't know what you're supposed to do. Maybe you're just going to have people being frustrated. Maybe the idea is that all products should contain sort of, to whatever extent possible, kind of walkthrough features, right? Like you don't have to go look at the manual. It just asks you what you want to do and helps you do it.
A walkthrough. But who wants to do that?
No, that's really annoying too.
Yeah, I don't want to do like a robotic walkthrough with my new microwave. I just want to use it when I have to, right?
Yeah, I don't know what to do about it. Do you want to burn popcorn? We're doing it either way.
Exactly. All right. Well, on that note, let's move on to our next award-winning study. Let's talk peace, Joe.
Okay. This is the 2018 Ig Nobel Peace Prize. It was awarded to Francisco Alonso, Cristina Esteban, Andrea Serge, Maria Luisa Ballastar, Jaime San Martin, Constanza Catalayud, Beatriz Alomar, for measuring the frequency, motivation, and effects of shouting and cursing while driving an automobile.
Ha.
And there are a couple of references here, one in the Journal of Sociology and Anthropology from 2017. Francisco Alonso attended the ceremony, but the authors write that, quote, evidence has shown that drivers who usually express aggressive behaviors more frequently tend at the same time to have higher rates of road crashes or traffic incidents. And so the situations in which aggressive behaviors arise tend to be very common, meaning that driver aggression is potentially a major traffic safety issue. And the authors administered a number of survey questions to Spanish drivers over the age of 14 to figure out their perceptions and attitudes about aggressive driving behaviors like shouting and insulting behind the wheel. And so I found a long-form version of this that I don't know is – it seems like the long-form version I found is not the study itself, but is a summary that was published after the prize was awarded, because it's got some really funny statements in the conclusion, such as, let us also remember that people use cars to make love as well, which is clearly better than eventually using them to get us killed. And also, as it happens with these prizes, we need to support laughters because they are not compatible with certain negative emotional states, and for sure they will lead us to peace.
Well, that's a nice sentiment.
Just to look at the data real quickly that they come up with, they say that about 26.4% of drivers admit that they sometimes insult other drivers or shout while driving.
I do that.
41.6% say they never do it. I don't know.
Liars.
I almost never do it, but sometimes they really get to you.
It's a real struggle for me, especially when I'm in the car driving the boy around and I'm really good at watching my language the rest of the time, I think, but when I'm in the car, it's a little harder. Luckily, he mishears me.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. For a while, he was convinced, hopefully he's still convinced that I sometimes refer to other drivers as funkies, and I should really try to do that instead of what I am saying.
That's a good one, funkies. You know, it's just funky driving.
Yeah.
A quick look also at the data about reasons people self-reported to initiate some shouting or insulting other drivers. Top one with 22.5% was reaction to breaking a rule. So when somebody else breaks a rule, that's when you
– I will shake my finger at them when they do that.
Also next at 21.4%, reaction to dangerous maneuvers. So when other people behave recklessly. Then below that at 13.6%, the other driver puts me in danger. Also at 13.6%, just stress, stress. But that's people being self-conscious, right? They're admitting, yeah, stress probably just makes me do it. Other reasons are below that. And then finally, 1.3% of people say they do it because, quote, everybody does it.
Ha. Now, something that's not reflected in this study, I just want to throw in. I recently watched The Ice Cream Man, a 1990s horror film starring Clint Howard. Mm-hmm. And Clint Howard apparently drove around yelling in his car in order to get his voice nice and raspy for the role.
Whoa.
So it's possible that that person you think is driving angry, it's just Clint Howard preparing for a leading role.
Method acting, yeah. All right, we need to take a quick break, but we will be right back with more Ig Nobels. Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision?
Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road, the steeper the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, we're back. Well, Robert, is it time for the Economics Prize?
It is, which, you know, the Economics Prize, it might not sound exciting, but this is a pretty good one.
It's often one of the funniest ones.
Yeah, because I think it's because it plays well with humor, because you think Economics Prize, you think something dry and stuffy, and in most cases they'll find something that has an instant pizzazz. In this case, the pizzazz comes in the form of voodoo dolls.
Nice.
So the particular paper here that's honored is titled "Righting a Wrong: Retaliation on a Voodoo Doll Symbolizing an Abusive Supervisor Restores Justice." And this was by Lang et al., published in the Leadership Quarterly, February 2018.
Do you think this study was funded by Big Voodoo?
No, and I'll get to that in a minute. Really, there's virtually no voodoo in any of this. There's
sort of a metaphorical voodoo doll.
Yeah. There's no Afro-American religion or folklore in this particular study at all.
Okay.
But it does center around a reality that a lot of us have been forced to face over the years, unfortunately, and that is abusive supervisor figures.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible bosses, mean bosses.
They exist.
They do. I've been lucky. I haven't had an abusive boss at least in a long time. But I did have one briefly at one point, and I remember it being pretty horrible to work under them.
What is counting as an abusive supervisor here? Is this like really egregious abuses, or just like being a jerk?
Well, it can cover a wide variety of things. It could be punching holes in walls. It could be it could be just yelling at subordinates, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There are a whole host of behaviors that fall under this umbrella. And whether you're dealing with big ones or supposedly little ones, I mean, it all can add up. It can all make one's work life rather dismal.
Mm-hmm.
And then what are you going to do, right? Hopefully, there's going to be a system in place, like via HR, to report such individuals. But as the authors of this 2018 paper point out, there may be a temptation for reprisal. In other words, to get revenge in some sense at the boss or superior that is being horrible.
But sort of by the dynamics of the workplace, you can't really do that, right? At least not in any kind of legitimate way.
Right. I mean, and that's something that they point out time and time again. Like they're not saying that reprisals are good. Reprisals are bad. Reprisals only just add more chaos to the workplace environment and cost the company money, et cetera. But here's one of the things they had to say in the study. Quote, when a subordinate receives abusive treatment from a supervisor, a natural response is to retaliate against the supervisor. Although retaliation is dysfunctional and should be discouraged, we examine the potential functional role retaliation plays in terms of alleviating the negative consequences of abusive supervision or subordinate justice perceptions. So, yeah, basically the idea is if you're pushed down by a terrible boss, mm-hmm. there is going to be this natural inclination to push back in some way, right?
So is there some way you can do that without making things worse for yourself and others?
Right. Yeah, because I think a lot of times it is about that, like what would feel good right now? Like nothing would feel better than to destroy the boss's bobblehead, you know.
Uh-huh.
But as fun as it might look on the Office or some other television show or film, it's not really necessarily a good move in the long run. Still, aggression against such supervisors is common, as high as 76% according to a cited 1999 study in this paper. And this is seemingly on par with aggressions toward coworkers as well, if not more prevalent. The authors point out that the prevalence of retaliation suggests that retaliation may play a functional role in dealing with abuse. And there are various theories as to why, an adaptive response, a way of rebalancing the relationship, etc. So it could be, I mean, not to put thoughts in everyone's head, I guess, on this matter, but it could be as simple as, okay, an otherwise okay boss like raises their voice at you. You feel a little hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Their bobblehead takes a little dive off the side of their table. The universe is restored, you know, because you're like, all right, you yelled at me and I didn't really like that, but the bobblehead is dead now.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see that as like, and okay, things are equal. How are they really equal? Well, that depends on all the other aspects of the office dynamics. So the authors here, they lay out a functional theory of retaliation whereby engaging in retaliation reaffirms one's sense of justice, and supervisor abuse is the external stressor that violates one's expectations of fair treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So to test this out, they made use of an online voodoo doll representing an abusive supervisor. And specifically in the wording of the paper, they use what they would call a voodoo doll task or VDT paradigm to manipulate retaliation.
Gotta love that sterile terminology.
Yeah. So again, there's nothing actually related to any kind of folkloric or religious practice here.
So it's not really a ritual. It's more just like the concept of enacting violence on some kind of effigy.
Right. Yeah. Such as, you know, very much the bobblehead in question. So the paper argues that retaliation might be an important way in which we deal with supervisor aggression, even though it should be discouraged and only creates more problems. Quote, in particular, we have proposed and found that subordinate retaliation can directly influence subordinate justice perceptions. These findings suggest that retaliation not only benefits individual victims, but may also benefit the organization as a whole, given that justice perception is important for employee performance and well-being.
So this is kind of like giving employees the illusion of some kind of retaliation, like that they haven't actually done anything to the boss, but if they just pretend they're retaliating, that makes the company a little more lubricated, everything's okay?
They're not saying, hey, you need to have a dunking booth every year, and that's the only way you're going to restore balance of your company. They say the take home is not that companies should encourage retaliation, but that they should instead foster, quote, subordinate justice perception. And one example of this is having a zero tolerance policy against various abusive behaviors. They also wonder if companies should rethink what is referred to as deviant subordinate behavior. This would be like breaking the bobblehead.
Okay.
Because the individuals here, the subordinates that are acting out, they might be attempting to resolve perceived injustices, and perhaps they really should be disciplined for what they're doing, but perhaps it also points to other issues in the workplace that have yet to be resolved.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you fire the guy for breaking the bobblehead, or you make the guy who broke the bobblehead take some sort of anger management toward toys class.
Mm-hmm.
But then you still have whatever the existing caustic dynamic happened to be between the boss and the employees. What do you do about that? Like that remains unchecked. So they're saying this kind of behavior could just be a canary in the coal mine, I guess.
So then, was the use of the abuse of the effigy task was that actually just to reveal some underlying attitudes, or are they actually suggesting something like that is useful?
I think they just used it to reveal in this case. Yeah.
Okay. So they're not saying like do a voodoo doll task.
No. The voodoo doll task is merely a part of the experiment and not part of any kind of solution that they are presenting.
Okay.
So, again, putting voodoo in the title of the paper, it's maybe selling the voodoo elements a little too strong.
Well, yeah, and I think often to refer to like any process by which the mechanics of which are unclear.
Mm-hmm.
I think about like the phrase like voodoo economics and stuff like that. I mean, it would be funny to sub in any other name of any other religion there, like calling it Christian economics or Hindu economics or something. It wouldn't make much sense. I don't know. I think maybe people should try to retire those uses of the word voodoo. It's a system of beliefs.
Yeah. You know, this would be a great excuse to come back at some point in the future and do a show on voodoo, because we could discuss what voodoo is/was. How it has been represented in our culture, and how the terminology has been utilized, well, in this case, in scientific studies, mm-hmm. but elsewhere as well.
Okay, time to turn to the Anthropology Prize. Very different kind of subject. This is going to deal with the concepts of learning and imitation and social mimicry. So you've heard the expression, obviously, monkey see, monkey do. The funny thing is that this is almost always applied to human children rather than monkeys. You know, people never say that about a monkey. They say that about a 4-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, it tends to highlight the very strong imitative tendencies of human children. Do you ever notice how like a child will seem to spontaneously, almost unconsciously mimic actions that they see? Like they watch something on TV or an adult doing something, and you'll see the child doing the same thing with their hands that the adult is doing or the person on TV is doing or something without even seeming to realize it.
Oh, yeah. Like the countless examples from my own child's life. But I specifically remember like watching him dance while watching Frozen when he was like super little.
Mm-hmm.
Like he doesn't even remember this, but during the dance scenes, he would move a little bit while watching it.
That's funny. I mean, I actually have very strong specific memories about this from when I was a little kid, like of suddenly becoming embarrassed because I realized I was spontaneously, unconsciously imitating an action I had just seen an adult do.
Hmm.
For example, I remember being very young and I was like watching a dude in my neighborhood using a jackhammer to tear up a concrete porch on the side of a house. And I realized I was like spontaneously pretending to use a jackhammer and making sounds with my mouth. And I suddenly realized this and I was like super embarrassed. But we do this for some reason, obviously. Why? One obvious answer is that imitation is an instinct related to what? The clear thing, learning, right?
Right. You see something, you sort of do it yourself. You imitate, and through imitation, you learn.
Right. And so the idea here is that it's adaptive to have an imitation instinct, because through this, you can have transgenerational transfer of ideas and behaviors. For example, you watch the skilled adult do something, throw a rock or make a hand axe, and you imitate their movements as a way of learning how to do the thing yourself. But there appears to be another biological function of imitation, which is that it plays a social communicative role. It prolongs prosocial interactions and generally promotes positive social relationships. And this latter role has been investigated in humans, but it's sort of underexplored or sometimes even thought to be absent in non-human primates like chimpanzees. There's clear evidence of other primates like chimpanzees, say, imitating behaviors of each other and of humans, especially in order to clearly learn how to do something. But what would be the evidence that there's this social communicative role in humans that's not necessarily there in chimpanzees? Well, one is this interesting fact that human children, but not apes, tend to what's called over-imitate. So here's an example I want to give you. If an adult is demonstrating the physical actions required to accomplish a goal, human children will usually copy directly all of the adult's actions, even if they're clearly irrelevant to achieve the goal. And meanwhile, chimpanzees will tend to ignore the irrelevant actions and figure out what's the important part to get the desired goal. So an example would be an adult picks up a colored block and then uses it to flip a switch on a box, and then the box opens to reveal a toy. Human children, especially starting around 2 years old, will copy this exactly. They'll pick up the colored block and use it to flip the switch to get the toy, mm-hmm. whereas the apes will just skip the block and they'll just flip the switch with their hands and get the toy. Another version I've heard is like you have a food item or a toy or something inside a box, and you have an adult go through these elaborate rituals with their hands before they open the doors of the box and get the thing out. Apparently, apes and human children will tend to copy all of the actions if the box is opaque. But if the box is clear and you can see the item inside, the human children will still copy all of the actions, but the apes will just reach in and get it.
So the real take home here would seem to be: do not bring a chimpanzee to communion,
right?
Because it's not going to follow any of the more ritual aspects of the thing. It's just going to go for the juice and bread.
Well, this is clear because this shows that even the presence of rituals seems to show that there's some role of imitation in human culture that mm-hmm. goes beyond just like learning useful skills that achieve goals. There's some type of imitation that happens between humans that seems to be purely social. And it's hypothesized by some that humans are actually better learners than apes in part because of this slavish copying of apparently pointless actions. You can imagine how this might help in like learning to perform actions that don't immediately result in a goal or reward, right? Mimicking behaviors with no obvious benefit also helps you learn more complex multi-step skills.
That's true. Plus, I also can't help but think of steps in performing tasks where the importance of some of those steps might be lost on a novice.
Exactly.
But later on, you realize, oh, that's really essential. I should wear a radiation suit while messing around with these rods.
Yes. So the question is, why do human children copy more perfectly and more pointlessly, whereas apes don't to the same extent? And one potential answer is that the human copying appears to be for more than just learning how to achieve goals. It's also playing this social communicative role where the imitation itself is useful not just for achieving mechanical goals, but for things like improving relationships between people. And this could be seen as somewhat parallel to, Robert, something I know you've read about before, the unconscious process of mirroring in human psychology and behavior, right? If you've never observed this, just do a quick experiment. Watch two coworkers separately and then watch them once they begin a conversation with each other. There's a very good chance that when they start talking to each other, you might be able to notice them beginning to show similar posture and nonverbal behaviors like gesturing without them seeming to notice that they're doing it. And this is an unconscious form of imitation known as mirroring. It appears to be a pro-social adaptation that builds feelings of closeness and rapport between people. And research shows that when other people mirror your actions, You have increased positive feelings. You trust them more. You feel closer to them. You're more likely to believe they share your attitudes and stuff like that. We like to mirror each other's behaviors because we like to be mirrored. It makes us feel good.
Yeah, this is always something very interesting to observe when we actually stop to observe it. Because there's like it's happening at a linguistic level. It's happening in the way we speak with our hands and how the other person may speak with their hands as well.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we're not running through all of this before we have a conversation. We're not saying, hey, how much do you want to use your hands during this conversation? I'm thinking about keeping it like mid-body level, but I could go wider.
I mean, it's generally entirely unconscious.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, I mean, we like it when it's unconscious, but like if you pointed it out and people were doing it consciously, it would seem psychopathic, right?
Yeah.
You would think like, oh my God, I'm being manipulated. I hate this if you thought the person was consciously doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, we do have all of this clearly conscious imitation going on with human children and with non-human primates with the distinctions we've talked about before. But this study that won the Ig Nobel this year, the Ig Nobel Anthropology Prize, focused on testing for evidence of social communicative imitation in non-human primates, in chimpanzees. So it's taking issue with that previous consensus that there is no social communicative imitation in non-human primates, that for the non-human primates, it's just basic, you know, mechanical learning imitation. And so the prize was given to Tomas Persson, Gabriel Alina Southwick, Elaine Madsen for, quote, collecting evidence in a zoo that chimpanzees imitate humans about as often and about as well as humans imitate chimpanzees.
Ah.
This was published in the journal Primates in the year 2018, so earlier this year. And so basically what happened is you had these researchers from Lund University in Sweden, and they studied spontaneous interactions between chimpanzees and human visitors at the Furuvik Zoo in Sweden. And what they found was interesting. They found that humans and chimpanzees spontaneously imitated each other at roughly the same rate, going both ways. About 10% of actions that each species performed were spontaneously imitated by the other. Though humans overall showed what they called a higher imitative precision. So like the humans' imitations of the apes were more finely tuned, you might say, a little bit more accurate. But the apes imitated the humans at the same rate that the humans imitated the apes. There was also some congruity in the kinds of actions imitated by both humans and chimpanzees, who tended especially to copy things like clapping the hands, pressing lips against the window, like kissing the glass, knocking on the glass with the hand, and knocking on the head with the hand. I like that one. But one thing you might notice about these imitated actions is that they're common, which means they're familiar, which means they're not new to the animal and they're not in service of any goal. They're not getting anything. Thus, the authors think that this is evidence of social communicative imitation, what's done for the purpose of bonding, building rapport, communicating intentions and so forth, rather than for learning how to do new tasks or accomplish goals. Another piece of evidence that the chimpanzees showed social communicative imitation is that interactions between humans and chimpanzees lasted longer on average when there was imitation than when there was none.
Hmm.
So the authors conclude that there's more evidence than previously thought that apes also evolved imitation instincts for social and communication reasons, not just for learning.
So maybe we could bring them to communion.
Maybe. That's a good – yeah. So I wonder. I mean, this obviously is in tension with some previous findings. So you got to wonder like what's causing the distinction there.
Hmm.
Maybe chimpanzees are just more goal-oriented.
They know what they want, and they tend to get it. I wonder how this plays into any of the Planet of the Apes movies, if this could be used to understand any character motivations there.
Well, like if Charlton Heston had only mirrored Dr. Zaius more,
yeah.
They might have gotten along better.
All right, so there you have it, the 2018 Ig Nobel Prizes. We've rolled through all the winners for this year in these two episodes. And again, some of them we gave more attention than others, and pretty much any of them touch on a topic that we either have discussed in the past or could easily discuss again in the future. So if you have particular thoughts on what episodes we should do in the future, just let us know. In the meantime, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find all the episodes of the podcast. You'll find links out to our various social media accounts. You'll find a tab at the top of the page for our store, our TeePublic store, where you can find all sorts of cool merchandise with our logo on it or stuff related to specific shows like All Hail the Great Basilisk or the Bicameral Mind or what's our fabulous black hole shirt, Joe?
Oh, the Sphere Catastrophe.
Yeah, super cool. Get that on a shirt, get it on a sticker, get it on a tote bag, frame it, put it on the wall. All those options are open to you.
You can even get it on a phone case.
Yes, I've been meaning to pick one of those up.
Oh, yeah, a phone case?
Yeah, they're pretty swank, yeah. And I need to protect my phone from me dropping it.
All right, well, thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, let us know how you found out about the show, how long you've been listening, where you listen from, that kind of fun stuff, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway the Great American Race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR, the Motor Racing Network.